This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Emily Burke. This Thursday, as the new school year approaches amid soaring COVID numbers, what's in store for Aussie children? And when it comes to workplace safety, one expert says rapid antigen tests are a crucial tool in the protection strategy. Well, no sooner had tennis star Novak Djokovic touched down in Melbourne, he was facing the prospect of being put straight back on a plane and sent home. Border officials cancelled his visa when he arrived at Tullamarine Airport, dashing any hopes of him playing at the Australian Open. They say he failed to provide appropriate evidence to meet the requirements of his entry, and the Prime Minister says the rules are the rules. But beyond that, it's all rather confusing. This comes just a day after news that Djokovic had been granted an exemption to play in the Open as he chases an historic 21st Grand Slam title. Alexia Atwood has been following the story. Alexia, what's happened here?
Emily, we understand that Novak Djokovic has been taken from Melbourne Airport to an immigration hotel where he's being detained. The drama started around midnight last night when Djokovic's plane touched down from Dubai. And we understand he was then taken away to a part of Tullamarine Airport by Border Force officials, where he was quizzed over his documents to prove his medical exemption. And that was much to the distress of his father, who had released a statement to Serbian media outlets saying that his son was being held captive and that he wasn't, if he wasn't let go, they'd take to the streets. And since landing, it's now been confirmed that Djokovic's visa application has been cancelled. The big question we're still not quite sure of is why. Yesterday, we learnt that the Victorian government set up an independent process with Tennis Australia where two panels would assess whether unvaccinated tennis players, without knowing their identity, had valid medical reasons for an exemption. And that process decided that Djokovic had a valid reason and could come to Australia unvaccinated. But since that decision, Border Force reviewed that exemption process and concluded that the visa would be revoked. So the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has spoken out today saying rules are rules. The world number one didn't receive star treatment, that Australia takes its immigration policies really seriously, and the strong border controls are why the COVID-19 death rate is low in this country. And he's basically said that Djokovic didn't provide the right evidence.
A visa is one issue, but you have to have a double vaccination, and that is assessed at the border. And he provided information to the airline to allow his entry onto the plane. But people get on that plane. That is not an assurance that they'll be able to come through Australia's border at the other side. Wasn't a problem necessarily with the visa. There are many visas granted. And if you have a visa and you're double vaccinated, well, you're very, very welcome to come. And I think this what this says to everybody in Australia, people are welcome in Australia. But if you're not double vaccinated and you're not an Australian resident or citizen, well, you can't come.
That's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, speaking there. Alexia, this is all unfolding in Melbourne. So what's the Victorian government had to say?
Well, it's a very confusing situation, I believe, even for the Victorian government. They're seeking clarification from Border Force, but the acting Victorian Sports Minister, Jala Pulford, has rejected claims that the Victorian government didn't provide enough evidence to support Djokovic's vaccination exemption, and there is suggestion that Border Force was using a different criteria.
There is a difference between that ATAGI standard that applies to all Australians for what constitutes a valid medical exemption to vaccination. There is a different standard that applies to that particular visa category that Novak was seeking to use.
Jala Pulford there, Victoria's acting sports minister. Alexia, where to from here? What happens now?
Emily, now that Djokovic's visa has been cancelled, He is likely to depart Australia at the earliest opportunity and not compete in the Australian Open, where he was seeking to win a record-breaking 21st Grand Slam. But his lawyers may appeal the decision, and it's unclear how quickly this could all happen. Now the task is to figure out what went wrong and why this is all being sorted out at the 11th hour when Djokovic had already landed in Australia.
Alexia Atwood, thank you. Well, the cancellation of Novak Djokovic's visa by the authorities here is attracting global attention. Serbia's president is vowing to fight for the tennis star. And while many Australians say they're no fan of the controversial player, they're embarrassed by the government's handling of his entry to the country. Samantha Donovan has more.
Once again, the Novak Djokovic controversy is lighting up talkback switchboards around the country. These listeners rang into Nine Media's Radio 3AW. Some were pleased his visa has been cancelled.
I pay my taxes. I'm a farmer. I work really hard. I would have felt that from, like, I love watching the tennis, sure, but there are people out there who have to get vaccinated to survive, to have a roof over their head, to have food on the table for their families. It is much more embarrassing if they let him into the country, because there are people who won't even get to watch the tennis.
Others were more concerned by the handling of Djokovic's entry to the country.
It's a complete farce, and we have become a joke. The best thing about Australia is that it promotes freedom of speech, democracy.
First of all, it's absolutely a disgrace. This just goes to show, as a Western world, totally against Serbians, because he's the world number one, he's anti-vax. Good on him. He can say what he wants. And now we just look like a joke as a nation.
I would like to thank Novak Djokovic for bringing to the attention of the world how farcical our federal government has been and all state governments have been since the start of this pandemic. There's been no positive collaboration and there's been no bipartisanship whatsoever between any of the parties. That's a bloody disgrace.
On Instagram, the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, issued a statement of defiance.
I've just finished my telephone conversation with Novak Djokovic. I told our Novak that the whole of Serbia is with him and that our bodies are doing everything to see that the harassment of the world's best tennis player is brought to an end immediately. In line with all norms of international law, Serbia will fight for Novak, truth and justice. Novak is strong, as we all know.
On radio station 3AW, Serbian journalist Saša Osmo described the mood of his compatriots.
To be honest, my thoughts is that this is a bit farcical, because it's obviously a political decision. I mean, I think everyone would be completely fine if Novak was denied the medical exemption and was told not to come to Australia, but he was obviously granted a medical exemption by two independent panels in Australia. This is just not the way you treat someone who's won Australian Open 9 times. You don't treat anyone like that.
Former Australian player Louise Plemming says the visa decision is a huge blow to the Serb.
You know, there's a lot of huge prizes that we're awaiting over the Australian Open time. Obviously, one being that 10th trophy that he would like to have held up. And that would give him incredible significance in the world of tennis, because he would then take on and receive the 21st Grand Slam. That would mean he's the greatest champion in the men's tennis. He would then surpass Roger and Rafa, where they all sit at 20 at the moment. This is a massive blow to his team. I can't even imagine how low they're feeling right now.
Macquarie University sport historian Keith Rathbone says this Djokovic saga is unprecedented.
It's really shocking, and part of me wants to say it's a very cynical ploy from a government who's failing in many other ways. They're trying to signal that they're tough on COVID, but I do think rules are rules, but also exceptions and bespoke COVID policies are good policy. We should make exemptions for people who want to visit their sick family. And we should make exemptions for people who are going to bring in a lot of money to the Australian economy, and particularly the Victorian economy. Tennis Australia had worked together with Team Serbia to try to get him in. They'd worked with the Victorian government to try to get him in. And I think if they'd had a more open process, we'd be happier all around.
Macquarie University sport historian Keith Rathbone. Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, the Prime Minister is asking the Federal and State Attorneys General to review workplace safety laws that require workers to be tested for COVID. Unions are warning against any watering down of occupational health and safety laws. Liam O'Brien is Assistant Secretary of the ACTU.
This is very disturbing and should send a shiver down the spine of every worker. We know that rapid tests are a really effective way at keeping COVID out of the workplace, and thousands of workplaces have already introduced rapid testing programs. We should not be watering down our work health and safety laws because Scott Morrison has failed to ensure that Australia has enough rapid tests in this country to make work safe.
Medical experts who specialise in workplace safety are calling on employers to step up all their COVID-safe policies. Dr. Karina Powers is an occupational and environmental physician and an expert with the AusSage group. She says rapid antigen tests are an essential part of the protection picture.
Rapid antigen tests add to layers of control in the workplace. They need to be done in a program for a workplace, not just simply a one-off and that's all fine. It should be a regular program of testing. And many small businesses will not be able to afford this additional cost. So it is worthwhile that the federal government looks at making rapid antigen tests free for business in need. A lot of these businesses are on their knees. This will keep falling over if government does not take good advice from occupational physicians about how to better protect workplaces in this acute outbreak and in the possibility or the likelihood of further variants and risk of lethal disease.
What are the implications of removing that obligation on employers to ensure that workers are clear of COVID as best they can be before they report for duty, and maybe take a look at different industries, whether it's abattoirs or aviation or aged care or education, hospitality, even when we look at distribution chains for retail?
It just becomes unviable for them to operate as a business. It just keeps falling over with repeated exposures and loss of clients and staff. If people are repeatedly becoming unwell or spreading disease to the community, it's not good for business. We have to have every level of control in place that we possibly practically can to be able to preserve the running of our business and to keep it durable.
When we have such widespread infection, though, and we're talking about Omicron, which is highly infectious and it really has a foothold in some states now, what do those controls even look like?
So in regard to my specialty area and business, I would be saying please encourage your workforce to be vaccinated with a third dose and make sure that your, as we know, immunity can wane, maybe even about 10 weeks after your third dose. So we need to start making sure that we've got safe air, good ventilation in our workplaces, which can be as simple as cross-ventilating with open windows, but also having some idea that sometimes you can't always cross-ventilate with windows and safe child-safe fans. Sometimes you do need to put in HEPA filters for those times where you're going to have bushfires or pollution, meaning that your windows are shut. You need to put masks in place, which is good quality masks. And these masks can be reused. You know, they're better quality, they're a bit more expensive, but they can be reused. And now people are saying you can keep reusing them and even until the elastic breaks on them, but you need to sun them. That's helpful. Obviously, if they get getting grotty and you can't breathe through them, you've got to throw them out. These things, you know, can be used more than it appears for some job areas.
What's the obligation on the employer under these circumstances when we have such rampant infection?
It's really important to note that employers have a duty of care to provide a safe workplace to their employees in any way they practically can. And sometimes some advice they may be given may not actually weigh up for them in a court of law.
What really, do you mean?
So, for instance, if someone, a manager, may have been advised by somebody to say, oh, the surgical masks will be fine in this particular hospital in a situation of community transmission, but in actual fact, a better protection would be the higher quality masks. And if that was able to be practically provided, it would have been better to have that in place. A judge may find on evidence that the knowledge was there and that people should use that.
Dr. Karina Powers, an occupational and environmental physician with the AusSage Group. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks so much for your company. As the start of the school year approaches and COVID cases keep soaring, families and teachers are weighing up the risks of sending students back into the classroom. Children aged 5 to 12 are eligible to get their first vaccination dose from next week, but many won't receive their second jab until well into the first term. Federal and state health bosses are working on a plan, but parents are worried about the risks of COVID infections at school. Stephanie Smale reports.
When Brisbane mum Rebecca heard the Prime Minister Scott Morrison's vow that students would be back in the classroom at the start of term one, this was her response.
My initial reaction was really just how? What's that going to look like?
Children aged between 5 and 12 can get their first COVID vaccination from next week and their second between 3 and 8 weeks later. The Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the rollout is happening right on time.
So on the back to school list, on the fridge, you know, get the pens and the pencils and the staplers or whatever you need, but on there says get vaccinated.
It's a tight time frame though. Rebecca points out both of her children will be about halfway through term one before they get their second jab. There's also the issue that children with COVID can't get vaccinated, so parents are having to delay appointments as infections spread. Despite the risk of widespread infection as classes resume, paediatrician and epidemiologist Professor Fiona Russell has welcomed the push to get kids back to school. She says regular rapid antigen tests could help control infections.
We would be recommending is that twice a week that staff and students test themselves with a rapid antigen test, and if they're negative, they go to school, and if they're positive, they stay home. So this will reduce the amount of disruption. There will be, of course, lots of positive tests that will come about, and that's why the Department of Education is so important that they have a workforce plan and a backup plan.
She wants Australia to follow Denmark's lead.
Denmark has opened up their schools today. And Denmark has, you know, one of the highest rates of Omicron infections in the world, and they've put in a solid school plan. They have opened their schools for children, recognising how important it is to have good classroom time because they've got all these other measures in place. So rapid antigen testing is really critical because you detect the infection early and then you should be staying home.
World Health Organisation member and Melbourne University epidemiologist Mary Louise McClaws agrees rapid antigen testing will be a huge help. But she is firmly against school starting on schedule with vaccination rates so low.
Frankly, children should have an extended holiday so that they don't have to go back to school until the majority from 5 to 11 have been fully vaccinated.
She argues going back to school on time could risk a super spreader event, and she's worried infections won't all be the Omicron strain.
There's an assumption that in Australia, Omicron is the lead variant of concern, and there's no evidence that that is the case yet.
Across the country, there's been more deaths from COVID, with 6 each in New South Wales and Victoria, and Queensland recording its first COVID death during the current outbreak. More than 65,000 new cases have been recorded across those states. As New South Wales authorities grapple with a buckling health system, elective surgery could be cancelled to relieve some of the stress. Here's Premier Dominic Perrottet on Nine Radio.
At the moment, the system is strong. We believe we will be certainly getting through this, but we'll need to make some changes. I would expect on elective surgery, and I would also expect in terms of our work with the private health system, in managing as we go through these increases of cases.
The New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet ending Stephanie Smale's report. A year ago today, an angry mob stormed the heart of US democracy as Joe Biden's election victory was being ratified. The rioters left the world stunned and it rattled the Americans, leaving many questioning the strength and meaning of the nation's democratic values. 12 months ago, and in the immediate aftermath of the riot, I spoke to Professor Wesley Widmyer, head of the Department of International Relations at the ANU. As an American abroad, what does your American heart say about today?
Well, it's broken. The only thing I can compare it to is, you know, as an American, whenever you see the skyline of my age, you see the skyline of New York and those buildings are missing, and it still causes an ache in my heart. And I think when you see the thugs going through the rotunda of the Capitol, which is the temple of our democracy, I think like many Americans, it just strikes you in the gut. You know, a temple of American democracy trashed like that, it's just very painful.
And a short time ago, I spoke to him about his reflections 1 year on.
And it was one of those things where you really thought if anything's going to bring people together, it's going to be an attack on the Capitol. And the fact that it hasn't, I think, is the even more disappointing thing than a year ago.
How deep are these divisions now?
I think it's pretty deep to the extent that, you know, you have one party and one interpretation of these events that are based on allegiance to an individual in Donald Trump and you know, tied up in a distinct kind of worldview where, you know, the events of January 6th are downplayed. You know, it wasn't a political event. It was just a few people getting out of hand at best, or, you know, a false flag, you know, event planted by Antifa at worst. And then you have people who, you know, on the other side, who see it as an existential threat to American democracy. And it's very hard to kind of bridge that divide. This isn't something where you think, you know, the marginal tax rate should be 25. I think it should be 35 and we compromise at 30. It's not a transactional kind of thing. It's a much more transcendental thing. And so much harder to overcome. And you know, as Trump fades, and if Trump fades, you know, hopefully one can get back, you know, kind of home to normalcy. But that's, I think, the challenge for American democracy right now, to kind of put together one worldview.
When we spoke last year, you talked about America being a country of angry minds marked by grievances and resentments, but the Americans hadn't seen it expressed so starkly by a president before. How do you reflect upon that now? Are those angry minds, those resentments still there? Can you see them fading? And if so, how?
I think one thing that where you see the differences in the angry minds is, And this is hard for me to fathom, and I'm speaking not as a political scientist now, but just as an individual. You know, when I talk to people back in the States, the incredible anger on the part of some at Joe Biden. You know, on the other hand, I and many others I talk to see Joe Biden as a comparatively an innocuous, technocratic, and decent figure. So there are angry minds, and one could, you know, in the early stages of, you know, the Trump phenomenon, look at the inequality of the last 30 years, look at the cultural divides within the country and say, okay, there is a there. There are reasons for people to be angry. But now, you know, when it's the anti-vaxxers, you know, when it's this anger at Joe Biden, you know, for reasons that are very hard to rationalize. Again, you know, with Trump, as difficult as Trump was to individually understand, there was a there with respect to inequality. And now with the constructions of January 6th, the constructions of the pandemic, that kind of conspiracy theorizing that used to be on the far right with things like QAnon, it's moved much more to the mainstream, and it's harder to engage and again, kind of find that common ground.
Do you recognize your home country?
The anger has always been there. I mean, the notion of a paranoid style in American politics, that's the title of a book that was written back in 1962. And it was a book written in 1962 that looked at these kinds of periods of anger going all the way back to the founding, right? Different kinds of nativism and racism, you know, it's always been there in American politics, lurking beneath the surface. I think what we said last year was this is the first time you've got a president or major political figures dabbling in this conspiracy theory. It used to be that it was, you know, kind of held off to the fringes, and respectable people may speak in code to it, but it was never, you know, espoused as directly as it has been espoused in recent years. So this isn't entirely new. And so in that sense, I recognize it. The concern is how prominent it's become. And that's, I think, that the challenge for this generation of American democracy and the Republic, to take what was a fringe thing in the darker corners of American politics and push them back there.
Professor Wesley Widmyer from the ANU. And that's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.